Chapter 21. A brief note to let you know that I have arrived safely in Scotland. I must say, I am glad to be here. London was stimulating as always, but I believe I needed a bit of quiet. I feel quite more focused and at peace here in the country. From the Countess of Kilmartin to her mother, the Dowager Viscountess Bridgerton, one day after her arrival at Kilmartin. 3 weeks later, Francesca still didn't know what she was doing. Michael had brought up the issue of marriage twice more, and each time she'd managed to dodge the question. If she considered his proposal, she would actually have to think. She'd have to think about him, and she'd have to think about John. And worst of all, she'd have to think about herself. And she'd have to figure out just what it was she was doing. She kept telling herself she would marry him only if she became pregnant. But then she kept coming back to his bed, allowing him to seduce her at every turn. But even that wasn't truly accurate any longer. She was delusional if she thought she required any seducing to make room for him in her bed. She'd become the wicked one, however much she tried to hide from the fact by telling herself that she was wandering the house at night in her bedclothes because she was restless, not because she was seeking his company. But she always found him. Or if not, she placed herself in a position where he might find her. And she never said no. Michael was growing impatient. He hid it well, but she knew him well. She knew him better than she knew anyone left on this planet, and even though he insisted he was courting her, wooing her with romantic phrases and gestures, she could see the faint lines of impatience curling around his mouth. He would begin a conversation that she knew would lead to the subject of marriage, and she always dodged it before he mentioned the word. He allowed her to get away with it, but his eyes would change, and his jaw would tighten, and then, when he took her, and he always did after moments like those, it was with renewed urgency, and even a touch of anger. But still, it wasn't quite enough to jolt her into action. She couldn't say yes. She didn't know why. She just couldn't. But she couldn't say no either. Maybe she was wicked, and maybe she was a wanton, but she didn't want this to end. Not the passion, and not, she was forced to acknowledge, his company either. It wasn't just the love-making. It was the moments after, when she lay curled in his arms, his hand idly stroking her hair. Sometimes they were silent, but sometimes they talked, about anything and everything. He told her about India, and she told him of her childhood. She gave him her opinions about political matters, and he actually listened. And he told her devilish jokes that men were never supposed to tell women, and women certainly weren't supposed to enjoy. And then, once the bed had stopped shaking with her mirth, his mouth would find hers, a smile embedded on his lips. "I love your laughter," he would murmur, and his hands would curl her to him. She'd sigh, still giggling, and they'd begin their passion anew. And Francesca would, once again, be able to hold the rest of the world at bay. And then she bled. It started, as it always did, just a few drops on the cotton of her chemise. She shouldn't have been surprised. Her cycles may not have been regular, but they always arrived eventually, and she already knew that hers was not a terribly fertile womb. But still, somehow, she hadn't been expecting it. Not yet, anyway. It made her cry. Nothing dramatic, nothing that racked her body and consumed her soul. But her breath caught when she saw the tiny drops of blood, and before she realised what she was doing, twin tears were trickling down her cheeks, and she wasn't even sure why. Was it because there would be no baby? Or was it, God help her, because there would be no marriage? Michael came to her room that night, but she sent him away, explaining that it wasn't the right time. His lips found her ear, and he reminded her of all the wicked things they could still do, blood or no, but she refused and asked him to leave. He looked disappointed, but he seemed to understand. Women could be squeamish about such things, but when she woke in the middle of the night, she wished he was holding her. Her menses didn't last long. It never did, And when Michael asked her discreetly if her time was through, she didn't lie. He'd have known if she had anyway. He always did. "Good," he said with a secret smile. "I've missed you." Her lips parted to say that she'd missed him too, but somehow she was afraid to say the words. He nudged her toward the bed, and together they tumbled, their bodies a tangle of arms and legs as they fell. "I dreamed of you," he said hoarsely, his hands pushing her skirt up to her waist. "Every night you came to me in dreams." One finger found her essence and dipped inside. "They were very, very good dreams," he finished, his voice hot and full of the devil. She caught her lip between her teeth, her breath coming in short gasps as his finger slid out and caressed her right where he knew it would make her melt. "In my dreams," he murmured, his lips hot at her ear, "you did unspeakable things." She moaned at the sensation. He could ignite her body with a single touch, but she went up in flames when he spoke like this. "New things," he murmured, spreading her legs wider. "Things I'm going to have to teach you tonight, I think."
"Oh, God!"
she gasped. He'd moved his lips to her thigh, and she knew what was coming. "But first, a bit of the tried and true," he continued, his lips tickling their way up toward their destination. "We have all night to explore." He kissed her then, just as he knew she liked it, holding her immobile with his powerful hands as his lips brought her closer and closer to the peaks of passion. But before she reached the apex, he moved away, his hands tearing at the fastenings of his trousers. He swore when his fingers trembled, when the button didn't slip free on the first try. And it gave Francesca just enough time to stop and think, the one thing she truly didn't want to do. But her mind was relentless, and it was unkind, and before she knew what she was doing, she'd scrambled from the bed, the word, "Wait!" flying from her lips, even as she flew across the room.
"What?"
he gasped.
"I can't do this."
"You can't..."
he stopped, unable to finish the question without taking a heaving breath.
"What?"
He'd finally had success with his trousers, and they had fallen to the floor, leaving her with a stunning view of his arousal. Francesca averted her eyes. She couldn't look at him. Not at his face. Not at his...
"I can't,"
she said, her voice shaking.
"I shouldn't. I don't know."
"I know,"
he growled, stepping toward her.
"No,"
she cried out, hurrying toward the door. She'd played with fire for weeks, tempting the fates, and she'd won her gamble. If there was ever a time to escape, this was it, and as hard as it was to leave, she knew that she must. She wasn't this sort of woman. She couldn't be.
"I can't do this,"
she said, her back now flat against the hard wood of the door.
"I can't. I
want to," she thought, even as she knew she shouldn't. She couldn't escape the fact that she wanted to anyway. But if she told him that, would he make her change her mind? He could do it, too. She knew he could. One kiss, one touch, and all of her resolve would be lost. He just swore and yanked his trousers back up.
"I don't know who I am any longer," she said. "I'm not this sort of woman."
"What sort of woman?"
he snapped.
"A wanton," she whispered. "Fallen."
"Then marry me," he shot back. "I offered to make you respectable from the beginning, but you refused."
He had her there, and she knew it. But logic didn't seem to have a place in her heart these days, and all she could think was, how could she marry him? How could she marry Michael?
"I wasn't supposed to feel this for another man," she said, barely able to believe that she'd spoken the words aloud.
"Feel what?"
he asked urgently. She swallowed, forcing herself to bring her eyes to his face.
"The passion,"
she admitted. His face took on a strange expression, almost one of disgust.
"Right," he drawled. "Of course. It's a damn good thing you have me here to service you."
No,
she cried out, horrified by the derision lacing his voice.
That's not it.
Isn't it?
No.
But she didn't know what was. He took a ragged breath and turned away from her, his body taut with tension. She watched his back with terrible fascination, unable to take her eyes off of him. His shirt was loose, and even though she couldn't see his face, she knew his body, every last curve of it. He looked desolate, hardened, worn out.
"Why do you stay?"
he asked in a low voice, leaning on the edge of the mattress with the flats of both hands.
"What?"
"Why do you stay?"
he repeated, his words rising in volume, but never losing control.
"If you hate me so much, why do you stay?"
"I don't hate you,"
she said.
"You know I—"
"I don't know a damned thing, Francesca,"
he bit off.
"I don't even know you any longer."
His shoulders tensed as his fingers bit into the mattress. She could see one of his hands. The knuckles had gone white.
"I don't hate you,"
she said again, as if saying it twice would somehow turn her words into solid things, palpable and real, that she could force him to hold on to.
"I don't. I don't hate you."
He said nothing.
"It's not you. It's me,"
she said, pleading with him now. For what, she wasn't certain. Maybe for him not to hate her. That was the one thing she didn't think she could bear. But all he did was laugh. It was a horrible sound, bitter and low.
"Oh, Francesca,"
he said, condescension lending his words a brittle flavour.
"If I had a pound for every time I've said that..."
Her mouth settled into a grim line. She didn't like to be reminded of all the women who had gone before her. She didn't want to know about them, didn't even want to recall their existence.
"Why do you stay?"
he asked again, finally turning around to face her. She nearly reeled at the fire in his eyes.
"Michael, I..."
"Why?"
he demanded, fury pounding his voice into a harsh rumble. His face had tightened into deep, angry lines, and her hand instinctively reached for the doorknob.
"Why do you stay, Francesca?"
he persisted, moving toward her with the predatory grace of a tiger.
"There is nothing for you here at Kilmartin. Nothing but this."
She gasped as his hands landed hard on her shoulders, let out a soft cry of surprise as his lips found hers. It was a kiss of anger, of brutal desperation. But still, her traitorous body wanted nothing more than to melt into him, to let him do what he wished, turn all of his wicked attentions on her. She wanted him. Dear God, even like this she wanted him, and she feared she would never learn to say no. But he wrenched himself away. He did it, not her.
"Is that what you want?"
he asked, his voice ragged and hoarse.
"Is that all?"
She did nothing, didn't even move, just looked at him with wild eyes.
"Why do you stay?"
he demanded, and she knew it was the last time he'd ask. She didn't have an answer. He gave her several seconds. He waited for her to speak, until the silence rose between them like a gorgon. But every time she opened her mouth, no sound emerged, and she couldn't do anything but stand there, shaking, as she watched his face. With a vicious curse, he turned away.
"Leave,"
he ordered.
"Now! I want you out of the house!"
What?
She couldn't believe it. Couldn't believe that he would actually toss her out. He didn't look at her as he said,
"If you can't be with me, if you can't give all of yourself to me, then I want you gone."
"Michael."
It was just a whisper. Barely that.
"I can't bear this halfway existence,"
he said, his voice so low she wasn't certain she'd heard correctly. All she could manage to say was,
"Why?"
At first she didn't think he was going to respond. His posture became impossibly taut, and then he began to shake. Her hand rose to cover her mouth. Was he crying? Could he be laughing?
"Oh, God, Francesca!" he said, his voice punctuated with derisive laughter. "Now there's a good one! Why?
He gave each one a different tenor, as if he were testing out the word, asking it to different people.
"Why?"
he asked again, this time with increased volume as he turned around to face her.
"Why? It's because I love you, damn me to hell! Because I've always loved you. Because I loved you when you were with John, and I loved you when I was in India. And God only knows I don't deserve you, but I love you anyway."
Francesca sagged against the door.
"How's that for a witty little joke?"
he mocked.
"I love you. I love you, my cousin's wife. I love you, the one woman I can never have. I love you, Francesca Bridgerton Sterling, who—"
"Stop!"
she choked out.
"Now? Now that I've finally gotten started? Oh, I don't think so,"
he said grandly, waving one of his arms through the air like a showman. He leaned in close, painfully, uncomfortably close, and his smile was terrifying as he asked,
"Are you scared yet,
Michael?"
"Because I haven't nearly begun,"
he said, his voice skipping over hers.
"Do you want to know what I was thinking when you were married to John?"
"No,"
she said desperately, shaking her head. He opened his mouth to say more, his eyes still flashing with his contemptuous passion. But then something happened. Something changed. It was in his eyes. They were so angry, so inflamed. And then they simply stopped, turned cold, weary. Then he closed them. He looked exhausted.
"Go,"
he said.
"Now."
She whispered his name.
"Go,"
he repeated, ignoring her plea.
"If you're not mine, I don't want you any more."
"But I..."
He walked to the window, leaning heavily on the sill.
"If this is to end, you will have to do it. You will have to walk away, Francesca. Because now, after everything, I'm just not strong enough to say goodbye."
She stood motionless for several seconds. And then, just when she was sure the tension between them would tighten and snap her in two, her feet somehow found purchase, and she ran from the room. She ran, and she ran, and she ran. She ran blindly, without thinking. She ran outside, into the night, into the rain. She ran until her lungs burned. She ran until she had no balance, was tripping and sliding in the mud. She ran until she could run no longer. And then she just sat, finding comfort and shelter in the gazebo John had erected for her years earlier, after throwing up his arms and announcing that he'd given up trying to get her to curb her lengthy hikes, and this way at least she'd have a place outside to call her own. She sat there for hours, shivering in the cold, but not feeling a thing. And all she could wonder was, just what was it she was running from? Michael had no memory of the moments that followed her departure. It could have been 1 minute. It could have been 10. All he knew was that he seemed to wake up when he realized he'd nearly put his fist through the wall. And yet, somehow, he barely noticed the pain.
"My lord!"
It was Rivers, popping his head in to inquire about the commotion.
"Get out,"
Michael growled. He didn't want to see anyone. Didn't want to hear anyone even breathe.
"But maybe some mice for—"
"Get out!"
Michael roared, and it felt as if his body were growing huge and monsterish as he turned. He wanted to hurt someone. He wanted to claw at the air. Rivers fled. Michael dug his fingernails into his palms, even as his right fist was beginning to swell. Somehow, the motion seemed the only way to keep the devil inside at bay, to prevent him from tearing the room apart with his very fingers. 6 years. He stood there, stock still, with only one thought in his head. 6 bloody years. He'd held this inside for 6 years, scrupulously kept his feelings off of his face when he watched her. Never told a soul. 6 years he'd loved her. and it had all come to this. He'd laid his heart on the table. He'd practically handed her a knife and asked her to slice it open. Oh, no, Francesca, you can do better than that. Hold steady there. You can easily make a few more cuts. And while you're at it, why don't you take these pieces here and dice them up? Whoever had said it was a good thing to speak the truth was an ass. Michael would have given anything, both his bloody feet even, to have made this all go away. But that was the thing about words. He laughed miserably. You couldn't take them back. Spread it on the floor now. There you go. Stamp it down. No, harder. Harder than that, Franny. You can do it. 6 years. 6 bloody years, all lost in a single moment. All because he'd thought he might actually have the right to feel happy. He should have known better. And for the grand finale, just set the whole bloody thing aflame. Brava, Francesca! There went his heart. He looked down at his hands. His nails had carved half moons into his palms. One had even broken the skin. What was he going to do? What the hell was he going to do now? He didn't know how to live his life with her knowing the truth. For 6 years, his every thought and action had revolved around making sure she didn't know. All men had some guiding principle in their lives, and that had been his. Make sure Francesca never finds out. He sat in his chair, barely able to contain his own maniacal laughter. Oh, Michael, he thought, the chair shaking beneath him, as he let his head fall into his hands. Welcome to the rest of your life. His second act, as it happened, opened far sooner than he'd expected, with a soft knock on his door about 3 hours later. Michael was still sitting in his chair, his only concession to the passage of time, the movement of his head from his hands to the seat back. He'd been leaning like that for some time now, his neck uncomfortable but unmoving, his eyes staring sightlessly at some random spot on the ecru silk fabric covering the wall. He felt removed, set apart, and when he heard the knock, he didn't even recognize the sound at first. But it came again, no less timid than the first, but still persistent. Whoever it was, he wasn't going away. Enter, he barked. He was a she, Francesca. He should have risen. He wanted to. Even after everything, he didn't hate her, didn't wish to offer his disrespect. But she had wrenched everything from him. Every last drop of strength and purpose, and all he could manage was a slight lifting of his brows, accompanied by a tired, "What?" Her lips parted, but she didn't say anything. She was wet, he realized, almost idly. She must have gone outside. Silly fool, it was cold out. "What is it, Francesca?" he asked. "I'll marry you," she said, so quietly he more read the words on her lips than did he hear them. "If you'll still have me." And you'd have thought he'd jump from his chair, rise at least, unable to tamp down the joy spreading through his body. You'd have thought he might stride across the room, a man of purpose and resolve, to sweep her from her feet, rain kisses on her face, and lay her on the bed, where he might seal the bargain in the most primitive manner possible. But instead, he just sat there, too heart-weary to do anything other than ask, "Why?" She flinched at the suspicion in his voice. But he didn't feel particularly charitable at the moment. After what she'd done to him, she could suffer a bit of discomfort herself. "I don't know," she admitted. She was standing very still, her arms straight at her sides. She wasn't rigid, but he could tell she was trying very hard not to move. If she did, he suspected, she'd run from the room. "You'll have to do better than that," he said. Her lower lip caught between her teeth. "I don't know," she whispered. "Don't make me figure it out."
He lifted one sardonic brow. "Not yet, at least," she finished.
Words, he thought, almost dispassionately. He'd had his words, and now these were hers.
"You can't take it back," he said in a low voice.
She shook her head. He rose slowly to his feet.
"There will be no backing out, no cold feet, no changed minds."
"No," she said. "I promise."
And that was when he finally let himself believe her. Francesca did not give promises lightly, and she never broke her vows. He was across the room in an instant, his hands at her back, his arms around her, his mouth raining desperate kisses on her face.
"You will be mine," he said. "This is it. Do you understand?"
She nodded, arching her neck as his lips slid down the long column to her shoulder.
"If I want to tie you to the bed and keep you there until you're heavy with child, I'll do it," he vowed.
"Yes,"
she gasped.
"And you won't complain?"
She shook her head. His fingers tugged at her gown. It fell to the floor with stunning speed.
"And you'll like it," he growled.
"Yes. Oh, yes."
He moved her to the bed. He wasn't gentle or smooth, but she didn't seem to want that, and he fell upon her like a starving man.
"You will be mine,"
he said again, grasping her bottom and pulling her toward him.
"Mine."
And she was. For that night, at least, she was.
Chapter 22.
"I am sure you have everything well in hand. You always do." From the Dowager Viscountess Bridgerton to her daughter, the Countess of Kilmartin, immediately upon the receipt of Francesca's missive. The hardest part about planning a wedding with Michael, Francesca soon realized, was figuring out how to tell people. As difficult as it had been for her to accept the idea, she couldn't imagine how everyone else might take it. Good God, what would Janet say? She'd been remarkably supportive of Francesca's decision to remarry, but surely she hadn't considered Michael as a candidate. And yet, even as Francesca sat at her desk, her pen hovering over paper for hours on end, trying to find the right words, something inside of her knew that she was doing the right thing. She still wasn't sure why she'd decided to marry him, and she wasn't sure how she ought to feel about his stunning revelation of love. But somehow she knew she wished to be his wife. That didn't, however, make it any easier to figure out how to tell everyone else about it. Francesca was sitting in her study, penning letters to her family, or rather, crumpling the paper of her latest misfire and tossing it on the floor, when Michael entered with the post.
"This arrived from your mother," he said,
handing her an elegantly appointed cream-coloured envelope. Francesca slid her letter opener under the flap and removed the missive, which was, she noted with surprise, a full 4 pages long.
"Good heavens,"
she murmured. Her mother generally managed to say what she needed to say with one sheet of paper, 2 at the most.
"Is anything amiss?"
Michael asked, perching himself on the edge of her desk.
"No, no," Francesca said distractedly. "I just... good heavens!"
He twisted and stretched a bit, trying to get a look at the words.
"What is it?"
Francesca just waved a shushing hand in his direction.
"Franny?"
She flipped to the next page.
"Good heavens!"
"Give me that,"
he said, reaching for the paper. She turned quickly to the side, refusing to relinquish it.
"Oh, my God!"
she breathed.
"Francesca Sterling, if you don't..."
"Colin and Penelope got married."
Michael rolled his eyes.
"We already knew."
"No, I mean they moved up the wedding date by... well, goodness, it must have been by over a month, I would think."
Michael just shrugged.
"Good for them."
Francesca looked up at him with annoyed eyes.
"Someone might have told me."
"I imagine there wasn't time."
"But that,"
she said with great irritation,
"is not the worst of it."
"I can't imagine."
"Eloise is getting married as well."
"Eloise?"
Michael asked with some surprise.
Was she even being courted by anyone?
No, Francesca said, quickly flipping to the third sheet of her mother's letter. It's someone she's never met.
Well, I imagine she's met him now,
Michael said in a dry voice.
I can't believe no one told me.
You have been in Scotland.
Still,
she said grumpily. Michael just chuckled at her annoyance. Drat the man.
It's as if I don't exist,
she said, irritated enough to shoot him her most ferocious glare.
Oh, I wouldn't say.
Oh, yes,
she said with great flair.
Francesca.
Franny. He sounded quite amused now.
Has someone told Francesca?
She said, doing a rather fine group impression of her family.
Remember her? 6th of 8. The one with the blue eyes.
Franny, don't be daft.
I'm not daft. I'm just ignored.
I rather thought you liked being a bit removed from your family.
Well, yes, she grumbled, but that's beside the fact.
Of course, he murmured. She glared at him for his sarcasm.
Shall we prepare to leave for the wedding?
He inquired.
As if I could, she said with great huff. It's in 3 days' time.
My felicitations, Michael said admiringly.
Her eyes narrowed suspiciously.
What is that supposed to mean?
One can't help but feel a great respect for any man who manages to get the deed done with such swiftness,
he said with a shrug.
Michael!
He positively leered at her.
I did.
I haven't married you yet,
she pointed out. He grinned.
The deed I was referring to wasn't marriage.
She felt her face go red.
Stop it,
she muttered. His fingers tickled along her hand.
Oh, I don't think so.
Michael, this is not the time,
she said, yanking her hand away. He sighed.
It starts already.
What does that mean?
Oh, nothing, he said, plopping down in a nearby chair. Just that we're not even wed, and already we're an old married couple.
She gave him an arch look, then turned back to her mother's letter. They did sound like an old married couple. Not that she wished to give him the satisfaction of her agreement. She supposed it was because, unlike most newly affianced pairs, they had known each other for years. He was, despite the amazing changes of the past few weeks, her very best friend. She stopped, froze.
Is something wrong? Michael asked.
No, she said, giving her head a little shake. Somehow, in the midst of her confusion, she'd lost sight of that. Michael may have been the last person she'd have thought she'd marry, but that was for a good reason, wasn't it? Who'd have thought she'd marry her best friend? Surely that had to bode well for the union.
Let's get married,
he said suddenly. She looked up questioningly.
Wasn't that already on the agenda?
No, he said, grasping her hand. Let's do it today.
Today?
She exclaimed.
Are you mad?
Not at all. We're in Scotland. We don't need bans.
Well, yes, but...
He knelt before her, his eyes aglow.
Let's do it, Franny. Let's be mad, bad and rash.
No one will believe it, she said slowly.
No one is going to believe it anyway.
He had a point there.
But my family, she added.
You just said they left you out of their festivities.
Yes, but it was hardly on purpose.
He shrugged.
Does it matter?
Well, yes. If one really thinks about...
He yanked her to her feet.
Let's go.
Michael.
And she didn't know why she was dragging her feet, except maybe that she felt she ought. It was a wedding, after all, and such haste was a bit unseemly. He quirked a brow.
Do you really want a lavish wedding?
No,
she said, quite honestly. She'd done that once. It didn't seem appropriate the second time around. He leaned in, his lips touching her ear.
Are you willing to risk an 8-month baby?
Obviously I was,
she said pertly.
Let's give our child a respectable 9 months of gestation.
he said jauntily. She swallowed uncomfortably.
"Michael, you must be aware that I may not conceive. With John, it took—"
"I don't care," he cut in.
"I think you do,"
she said softly, worried about his response, but unwilling to enter into marriage without a clear conscience.
"You've mentioned it several times, and—"
"To trap you into marriage," he interrupted. And then, with stunning speed, he had her back against the wall, his body pressed up against hers with startling intimacy. "I don't care if you're barren," he said, his voice hot against her ear. "I don't care if you deliver a litter of puppies." His hand crept under her dress, sliding right up her thigh. "All I care about," he said thickly, one finger turning very, very wicked, "is that you're mine." Francesca yelped, feeling her limbs go molten.
"Oh, yes."
"Yes on this?" he asked devilishly, wiggling his finger just enough to drive her wild. "Or yes on getting married today?"
"On this," she gasped. "Don't stop."
"What about the marriage?" Francesca grabbed his shoulders for support. "What about the marriage?" he asked again, quickly withdrawing his finger.
"Michael,"
she wailed. His lips spread into a slow, feral smile. "What about the marriage?"
"Yes," she begged. "Yes, whatever you want."
"Anything?"
"Anything,"
she sighed. "Good," he said, and then abruptly he stepped away, leaving her slack-jawed and rather mussed. "Shall I retrieve your coat?" he inquired, adjusting his cuffs. He was the perfect picture of elegant manhood, not a hair out of place, utterly calm and composed. She, on the other hand, was quite certain she resembled a banshee.
"Michael,"
she managed to ask, trying to ignore the extremely uncomfortable sensation he'd left down in her lower regions. "If you want to finish," he said, in much the same tone he might have used while discussing grouse hunting, "you'll have to do so as the Countess of Kilmartin."
"I am the Countess of Kilmartin,"
she growled. He gave her a nod of acknowledgement. "You'll have to do it as my Countess of Kilmartin," he corrected. He gave her a moment to respond, and when she did not, he asked again, "Shall I get your coat?" She nodded. "Excellent choice," he murmured. "Will you wait here, or accompany me to the hall?" She pried her teeth apart to say,
"I'll come out to the hall."
He took her arm and guided her to the door, leaning down to murmur, "Eager little thing, aren't we?"
"Just get my coat,"
she ground out. He chuckled, but the sound was warm and rich, and already she felt her irritation beginning to melt away. He was a rogue and scoundrel, and probably 100 other things as well. But he was her rogue and scoundrel, and she knew he possessed a heart as fine and true as any man she could ever hope to meet. Except for... She stopped short and jabbed one finger against his chest.
"There will be no other women," she said sharply.
He just looked at her with one arched brow.
"I mean it. No mistresses, no dalliances, no—"
"Good God, Francesca," he cut in. "Do you really think I could? No, scratch that. Do you really think I would?" She'd been so caught up in her own intentions that she hadn't really looked at his face, and she was stunned by the expression she saw there. He was angry, she realized, irked that she'd even asked. But she couldn't dismiss out of hand a decade of bad behaviour, and she didn't think he had the right to expect her to. So she said, lowering her voice slightly,
"You don't have the finest reputation."
"For God's sake," he grunted, yanking her out into the hall. "They were all just to get you out of my mind anyway." Francesca was shocked into stumbling silence as she followed him toward the front door. "Any other questions?" he asked, turning to her with such a supercilious expression that one would have thought he'd been born to the earldom rather than fallen into it by chance.
"Nothing,"
she squeaked. "Good,"
Now let's go. I have a wedding to attend.
Later that night, Michael couldn't help but be pleased by the day's turn of events.
Thank you, Colin, he said rather jovially to himself as he undressed for bed. And thank you, too, whomever you are, for marrying Eloise on a moment's notice.
Michael rather doubted that Francesca would have agreed to a rushed wedding if her two siblings hadn't up and gotten married without her. And now she was his wife. His wife. It was almost impossible to believe. It had been his goal for weeks, and she'd finally agreed the night before. But it wasn't until he'd slid the ancient gold band onto her finger that it had sunk in. She was his. Until death do they part.
Thank you, John, Michael added, the levity leaving his voice.
Not for dying, never for that, but rather for releasing him of the guilt. Michael still wasn't quite certain how it had come about, but ever since that fateful night, after he and Francesca had made love at the gardener's cottage, Michael had known, in his heart of hearts, that John would have approved. He would have given his blessing, and in his more fanciful moments, Michael liked to think that if John could have chosen a new husband for Francesca, he would have selected him. Clad in a burgundy robe, Michael walked to the connecting door between his and Francesca's rooms. Even though they had been intimate since his arrival at Kilmartin, it was only today that he had moved into the Earl's bedchamber. It was odd. In London, he hadn't been so worried about appearances. They'd taken residence in the official bedrooms of the Earl and Countess and simply made sure the entire household was aware that the connecting door was firmly locked from both sides. But here in Scotland, where they were behaving in a manner deserving of gossip, he'd been careful to unpack his belongings in a room as far down the hall from Francesca's as was available. It didn't matter that one, or the other of them, had been sneaking back and forth the whole time. At least they gave the appearance of respectability. The servants weren't stupid. Michael was quite sure they'd all known what was going on. But they adored Francesca, and they wanted her to be happy, and they would never breathe a word against her to anyone. Still, it was rather nice to put all of that nonsense behind them. He reached for the doorknob, but didn't grasp it right away, stopping instead to listen for sounds in the next room. He didn't hear much. He didn't know why he'd thought he might. The door was solid and ancient, and not inclined to give up secrets. Still, there was something about the moment that called to him, that begged for savouring. He was about to enter Francesca's bedchamber, and he had every right to be there. The only thing that might have made it better would be if she had told him she loved him. The omission left a small, niggling spot on his heart, but that was more than overshadowed by his newfound joy. He didn't want her to say words she did not feel, and even if she never loved him, as a wife ought to love her husband, he knew that her feelings were stronger and more noble than what most wives felt for their husbands. He knew that she cared for him, loved him deeply as a friend, and if anything were to happen to him, she would mourn him with every inch of her heart. He really couldn't ask for more. He might want more, but he already had so much more than he'd ever hoped for. He shouldn't be greedy. Not when on top of everything he had the passion. And there was passion. It was almost amusing how much it had surprised her, how much it continued to surprise her each and every day. He had used it to his advantage. He knew that. And he wasn't ashamed. He'd used it that very afternoon, while trying to convince her to marry him right then and there. And it had worked. Thank God it had worked. He felt giddy, like a green boy. When the idea had come to him, to wed that day, it had been like a strange shot of electricity through his veins, and he'd barely been able to contain himself. It had been one of those moments when he knew he had to succeed, would have done anything to win her over. Now, as he stood on the threshold of his marriage, he couldn't help but wonder if it would be different now. Would she feel different in his arms as his wife than she had as his lover? When he looked upon her face in the morning, would the air feel changed? when he saw her across a crowded room. He gave his head a little shake. He was turning into a sentimental fool. His heart had always skipped a beat when he saw her across a crowded room. Anything more, and he didn't think the organ could take the strain. He pushed open the door. "Francesca," he called out, his voice soft and husky in the night air. She was standing by the window, clad in a nightgown of deep blue. The cut was modest, but the fabric clung, and for a moment Michael couldn't breathe. And he knew, he didn't know how, but he knew that it would always be like this. "Franny," he whispered, moving slowly toward her. She turned, and there was hesitation on her face. Not nervousness, precisely, but rather an endearing expression of apprehension, as if she, too, realized that it was all different now. "We did it," he said, unable to keep a loopy smile off of his face.
"I still can't believe it," she said.
"Nor can I," he admitted, reaching out to touch her cheek. "But it's true." She shook her head.
"Never mind."
"What were you going to say?"
"It's nothing."
He took both of her hands and tugged her toward him. "It's not nothing," he murmured. "When it's you and when it's me, it's never nothing." She swallowed, shadows playing across the delicate lines of her throat, and she finally said,
I wanted to say...
His fingers tightened around hers, lending her encouragement. He wanted her to say it. He hadn't thought he needed the words. Not yet, anyway. But, dear God, how much he wanted to hear them.
"I'm very glad I married you,"
she finished, her voice matching the uncharacteristically shy expression on her face.
"It was the right thing to do."
He felt his toes clench slightly, gripping the carpet as he tamped down his disappointment. It was more than he'd ever thought to hear from her, and yet so much less than he'd hoped. And yet, even with that, she was still here in his arms, and she was his wife, and that, he vowed fiercely to himself, had to count for something. "I'm glad, too," he said softly, and pulled her close. His lips touched hers, and it was different when he kissed her. There was a new sense of belonging, and lack of furtiveness and desperation. He kissed her slowly, gently, taking the time to explore her, to relish every moment. His hands slid along the silk of her nightgown, and she moaned as the fabric bunched under his fingers. "I love you," he whispered, deciding there was no use in holding the words to himself any longer, even if she wasn't inclined to say the same. His lips moved across her cheek to her ear, and he nibbled gently on her lobe, before moving down her neck to the delectable hollow at the base of her throat.
"Michael," she sighed, swaying into him. "Oh, Michael."
He cupped her bottom and pressed her to him, a groan slipping across his lips as he felt her tight and warm against his arousal. He'd thought he'd wanted her before, but this was different. "I need you," he said hoarsely, dropping to his knees as his lips slid down the centre of her, over the silk. "I need you so much." She whispered his name, and she sounded confused as she looked down at him, at his position of supplication. "Francesca," he said, and he had no idea why he was saying it, just that her name was the most important thing in the world right then. Her name and her body and the beauty of her soul. "Francesca," he whispered again, burying his face against her belly. Her hands settled on his head, fingers entwined in his hair. He could have remained like that for hours, on his knees before her. But then she dropped down too, and she moved toward him, arching her neck as she kissed him.
"I want you," she said. "Please."
Michael groaned, pulling her toward him, and then pulling her to her feet before tugging her toward the bed. In moments they were on the mattress, the soft down of it drawing them in, embracing them even as they embraced each other. "Franny," he said, his trembling fingers sliding her silk gown up and over her waist. One of her hands cupped the back of his head, and she pulled him down for another kiss, this one deep and hot.
"I need you," she said,
her voice almost a groan of need.
"I need you so much."
"I want to see all of you," he said, practically tearing the silk from her body. "I need to feel all of you." Francesca was as eager as he was, and her fingers went to the sash on his robe, untying the loose knot before pushing it open, revealing the broad expanse of his chest. She touched the light dusting of hair, almost feeling a sense of wonder as her hand moved across his skin. She'd never thought to be in this place, in this moment. This certainly wasn't the first time she'd seen him this way, touched him in this manner, but somehow it was different now. He was her husband. It was so hard to believe, and yet it felt so perfect and right.
"Michael,"
she murmured, tugging the robe over his shoulders. "Hmm," was his reply. He was busy doing something delectable to the back of her knee. She fell back against the pillows, completely forgetting what she'd been about to say, if there had been anything at all. His hand wrapped lightly around the front of her thigh, then slid up toward her hip, to her waist, and then finally to the side of her breast. Francesca wanted to take part, wanted to be adventurous and touch him as he was touching her, but his caresses were making her languid and lazy, and all she could do was lie back and enjoy his ministrations, occasionally reaching out to trail her fingers along whichever part of his skin they were able to reach. She felt cherished, worshipped, loved. It was humbling. It was exquisite. It was sacred and seductive, and it took her breath away. His lips followed the trail his hands had forged, sending tingles of desire up and across her belly, coming to rest in the flattened hollow between her breasts. "Francesca," he murmured, kissing his way to her nipple. He teased it first with his tongue, then took it in his mouth, biting it gently. The sensation was intense and immediate. Her body convulsed, and her fingers gripped frantically into the bedsheets, desperate for purchase in a world that had suddenly tilted right off its axis.
"Michael,"
she gasped, arching her back. His fingers had slipped between her legs. Not that she needed anything more to ready her for his eventual entry. She wanted this, and she wanted him, and she wanted it to last forever.
"You feel so good,"
he said hoarsely, his breath hot on her skin. He moved then, positioning himself at her entrance. His face was over hers, nose to nose, and his eyes glowed hot and intense. Francesca wiggled beneath him, the movement tipping her hips to welcome him more deeply.
"Now,"
she said, the word a cross between an order and a plea. He moved slowly, inching his way inside with tantalizing deliberation. She felt herself opening, stretching to greet him, until their bodies touched, and she knew that he was embedded fully.
"Oh, my God,"
he grunted, his face stretched taut with passion.
"I can't. I have to..."
She answered by arching her hips, pressing herself even more firmly against him. He began to move within her, each stroke bringing a new wave of sensation that spread and burned through her body. She said his name, and then she could not speak, could do nothing but gasp for air as their movements grew more frenzied and desperate. And then it came upon her, in a lightning wave of pleasure. Her body exploded, and she cried out, unable to contain the intensity of the experience. Michael thrust into her harder, and then again and again. He called out as he climaxed, her name a prayer and a benediction on his lips, and then he collapsed atop her.
"I'm too heavy,"
he said, making a half-hearted attempt to move off of her.
"Don't,"
she said, stilling him with her hand. She didn't want him to move, not yet. Soon it would be hard to breathe, and he'd have to adjust. But for now, there was something elemental in their position, something to which she wasn't ready to bid farewell.
"No,"
he said, and she could hear a smile in his voice.
"I'll crush you."
He slid off of her, but he didn't relinquish their closeness, and she found herself curled next to him like a nested spoon, her back warmed by his skin, her body held snugly in place by his arm under her breasts. He murmured something against her neck, and she couldn't really understand the words, but that didn't matter. She knew what he'd said. He nodded off soon after, his breath a slow and steady lullaby at her ear. But Francesca did not sleep. She was tired, she was drowsy, and she was sated, but she did not sleep. It had been different tonight, and she was left wondering why.
Chapter 23.
I am sure that Michael will be penning a letter as well, but as I count you as a dear, dear friend, I wanted to write to you myself to inform you that we have married. Are you surprised? I must confess that I was.
From the Countess of Kilmartin to Helen Stirling, 3 days after her marriage to the Earl of Kilmartin.
You look terrible.
Michael turned to Francesca with a somewhat dry expression. And good morning to you too, he remarked, turning his attention back to his eggs and toast. Francesca slid into place across the breakfast table from him. It was 2 weeks into their marriage. Michael had risen early that morning, and when she'd awakened, his side of the bed had been cold.
I'm not joking, she said,
feeling her concern knit her brows into a wrinkled line.
You look quite pasty, and you're not even sitting up straight. You should go back to bed and get some rest.
He coughed, then coughed again, the second spasm racking his body.
I'm fine,
he said, although the words came out rather like a gasp.
You're not fine.
He rolled his eyes.
Married a fortnight and already...
If you didn't wish for a nagging wife, you shouldn't have married me, Francesca said,
judging the distance across the table, and deciding that she couldn't reach far enough to touch his forehead to check for fever.
"I'm fine,"
he said firmly, and this time he picked up his copy of the London Times, several days old, but as current as they could expect in the Scottish border counties, and proceeded to ignore her. Two could play at that game, Francesca decided, and she devoted her attention to the always challenging task of spreading jam on her muffin. Except he coughed. She shifted in her seat, trying not to say anything. He coughed again, this time turning away from the table so that he could bend over a bit. He gave her a look of such ferocity that she shut her mouth. She narrowed her eyes. He inclined his head in an annoyingly condescending manner, then had the effect ruined when his body convulsed with another spasm.
"That's it," Francesca announced, rising to her feet. "You are going back to bed, now."
"I'm fine," he grunted.
"You're not fine."
"I'm
sick,"
she interrupted.
"You're sick, Michael. Diseased, ill, plague-ridden. You're sick as a dog. I don't see how I could possibly make it any more clear."
"I haven't got the plague," he muttered.
No,
she said, coming around the table to grasp his arm.
But you do have malaria, and...
It's not malaria,
he said, whacking his chest as he coughed again. She pulled him to his feet, a task she couldn't have completed without at least a bit of assistance on his part.
How do you know that? She asked.
I just do.
She pursed her lips.
And you speak with the medical expertise that comes from...
Having had the disease for the better part of a year, he cut in. It's not malaria.
She nudged him toward the door.
Besides, he protested, it's too soon.
Too soon for what?
For another attack, he explained wearily. I just had one in London. What was it, 2 months ago? It's too soon.
Why is it too soon?
She asked, her voice strangely quiet.
It just is, he muttered,
but inside he knew a different truth. It wasn't too soon. He'd known plenty of people who'd had their malarial attacks 2 months apart. They'd all been sick, really sick. Quite a few of them had died. If his attacks were coming closer together, did that mean the disease was winning? Now there was irony for you. He'd finally married Francesca, and now he might be dying.
"It isn't malaria,"
he said again, this time with enough force to make her stop walking and look up at him.
"It isn't,"
he said. She just nodded. "It's probably a cold," he said. She nodded again, but he got the distinct impression that she was placating him.
"I'll take you to bed,"
she said softly, and he let her. 10 hours later, Francesca was terrified. Michael's fever was rising, and although he was not delirious or incoherent, it was clear that he was very, very ill. He kept saying that it wasn't malaria, that it didn't feel like malaria, but every time she pressed him for details, he couldn't explain why, at least not to her satisfaction. She didn't know much about the disease. The fashionable ladies' bookshops in London declined to carry medical texts. She'd wanted to ask her own doctor, or even seek an expert at the Royal College of Physicians, but she had made a promise to Michael that she would keep his illness a secret. If she ran around town making queries about malaria, eventually someone would want to know why. Thus, most of what she knew she had learned from Michael during the few short months he'd been back from India. But it didn't seem right that the attacks were coming closer together. Not, she had to allow, that she possessed any medical knowledge upon which to base that assumption. When he'd fallen ill in London, he'd said that it had been 6 months since his last set of fevers, and 3 before that. Why would the disease suddenly change course and attack again so quickly? It just didn't make sense. Not if he was getting better. And he had to be getting better. He had to be. She sighed, reaching out to touch his forehead. He was sleeping now, snoring slightly, as he tended to when he was congested, or so he'd told her. They hadn't been married long enough for her to have gained that knowledge firsthand. His skin was hot, although not burningly so. His mouth looked parched, so she spooned some tepid tea over his lips, tilting up his chin to try to help him swallow in his sleep. Instead, he choked and came awake, spewing the water across the bed.
"Sorry,"
Francesca said, surveying the damage. At least it had been a small spoonful.
"What the devil are you doing to me?"
he sputtered.
"I don't know," she admitted. "I haven't much experience nursing. You looked thirsty."
"Next time I'm thirsty, I'll tell you," he grumbled.
She nodded her agreement and watched as he tried to make himself comfortable again.
"You wouldn't happen to be thirsty right now?"
she asked in a mild voice.
"Just a bit,"
he said, his syllables slightly clipped. Without a word, she held out the cup of tea. He downed it all in one long gulp.
"Would you like another cup?"
He shook his head.
"Any more, and I'm going to have to..."
He broke off and cleared his throat.
"Sorry," he mumbled.
"I have 4 brothers," she said. "Pay it no mind. Would you like me to fetch you the chamber pot?"
"I can do it myself."
He didn't look well enough to cross the room on his own, but she knew better than to argue with a man in that irritable a state. He would come to his senses when he tried to stand and fell right back down against the bed. No amount of argument or reason on her part would convince him otherwise.
"You're quite feverish,"
she said softly.
"It isn't malaria."
"I didn't say..."
"You were thinking it."
"What happens if it is malaria?" she asked.
"It's not."
"But what if it is?"
she cut in. And to her horror, her voice had that awful pitch to it, that roundish sound of terror it made just before it actually choked. Michael looked at her for several seconds, his eyes grim. Finally, he just rolled over and said,
"It's not."
Francesca swallowed. She had her answer now.
"Do you mind if I leave?"
she blurted out, standing up so quickly the blood rushed from her head. He didn't say anything, but she could see him shrug under the covers.
"It's just for a walk,"
she explained haltingly, making her way to the door. "Before the sun goes down."
"I'll be fine," he grunted.
She nodded, even though he wasn't looking at her.
"I'll see you soon,"
she said, but he'd already fallen back asleep. The air was misty and threatened more precipitation, so Francesca grabbed a rain parasol and made her way to the gazebo. The sides were open to the elements, but it had a roof, and should the heavens open, she would remain at least nominally dry. But with every step, it felt as if her breathing was growing more laboured, and by the time she reached her destination, she was heaving with exertion, not from the walk, but just from keeping the tears at bay. The minute she sat down, she stopped trying. Each sob was huge, and hugely unladylike, but she didn't care. Michael might be dying. For all she knew, he was dying, and she was going to be a widow twice over. It had nearly killed her last time, and she just didn't know if she was strong enough to go through it all again. She didn't know if she wanted to be strong enough. It wasn't right, and it wasn't fair, damn it all, that she should have to lose two husbands when so many women got to hold on to one for an entire lifetime, and most of those women didn't even like their spouses, whereas she, who actually loved them both... Francesca's breath caught. She loved him. Michael? No, she assured herself. She didn't love him. Not like that. When she'd thought it, when the word had echoed through her brain, she'd meant in friendship. Of course she loved Michael that way. She'd always loved him, right? He was her best friend. Had been even back when John was alive. She pictured him. Saw his face. His smile. She closed her eyes, remembered his kiss, and the perfect feeling of his hand at the small of her back as they walked through the house. And she finally figured out why everything had seemed different between them of late. It wasn't, as she'd originally supposed, just because they'd married. It wasn't because he was her husband, because she wore his ring on her finger. It was because she loved him. This thing between them, this bond, it wasn't just passion, and it wasn't wicked. It was love, and it was divine. And Francesca could not have been more surprised if John had materialized before her and started to dance an Irish reel. Michael. She loved Michael, not just as a friend, but as a husband and a lover. She loved him with the depth and intensity she'd felt for John. It was different, because they were different men, and she was different now, too. But it was also the same. It was the love of a woman for a man, and it filled every corner of her heart. And by God, she didn't want him to die.
"You can't do this to me!"
she yelled, hanging over the side of the gazebo bench and looking up at the sky. A fat raindrop landed on the bridge of her nose, splashing into her eye.
"Oh, no, you don't!"
she growled, wiping the moisture away.
"Don't think you can—"
Three more drops in rapid succession.
"Damn,"
Francesca muttered, followed by a
"sorry,"
aimed back up at the clouds. She pulled her head back into the gazebo, taking refuge under the wooden roof as the rain grew in intensity. What was she supposed to do now? Charge forth with all the single-minded purpose of an avenging angel— or have a good cry and feel sorry for herself, or maybe a little of both. She looked out at the rain, which was now thundering down with enough force to strike fear in the heart of even the most determined of avenging angels. Definitely a little of both. Michael opened his eyes, surprised to discover that it was morning. He blinked a few times, just to verify this fact. The curtains were drawn shut, but not all the way, and there was a clear streak of light making a stripe along the carpet. Morning. Well, he must have been really tired. The last thing he remembered was Francesca dashing out the door, stating her intention to go for a walk, despite the fact that any fool would have realized that it was going to rain. Silly woman. He tried to sit up, then quickly flopped back down on the covers.
Damn,
He felt like death. Not, he allowed, the finest metaphor under the circumstances, but he couldn't think of much else that would adequately describe the ache that permeated his body. He felt exhausted, nearly glued to the sheets. The mere thought of sitting up was enough to make him groan. Damn, he was miserable. He touched his forehead, trying to ascertain if he still had a fever, but if his brow was hot, then so was his hand. He couldn't tell a thing, other than the fact that he was damned sweaty and certainly in need of a good bath. He tried to sniff the air around him, but he was so congested that he ended up coughing. He sighed. Well, if he stank, at least he didn't have to smell it. He heard a soft sound at the door and looked up to see Francesca entering the room. She moved quietly on stockinged feet, clearly trying to avoid disturbing him. As she approached the bed, however, she finally looked at him and let out a little, "Oh!" of surprise. "You're awake," she said. He nodded.
"What time is it?"
8:30. Not too late, really, except that you fell asleep last evening before the supper hour."
He nodded again, since he didn't really have anything pertinent to add to the conversation, and besides that, he was too tired to speak.
"How are you feeling?" she asked, sitting down beside him. "And would you like something to eat?"
"Like hell. And no, thank you."
Her lips curved slightly.
"Something to drink?"
He nodded. She picked up a small bowl that had been sitting on a nearby table. A saucer had been resting on top of it, presumably to keep the contents warm.
"It's from last night," she said apologetically, "but I've had it covered, so it shouldn't be too dreadful."
"Broth?"
he asked. She nodded, holding a spoon to his lips.
"Is it too cold?"
He sipped a little, then shook his head. It was barely lukewarm, but he didn't think he could stand anything overheated anyway. She fed him in silence for a minute or so, and then, once he said he'd had enough, she set the bowl back down, carefully replacing the lid, even though he imagined she would wish to order up a new bowl for his next meal.
"Do you have a fever?"
she whispered. He tried to summon a devil-may-care smile.
"I have no idea."
She reached out to touch his forehead.
"Didn't have time to bathe,"
he mumbled, apologizing for his slippery visage without actually uttering the word sweat in her presence. She made no sign of having heard his attempt at a joke. Instead, just furrowed her brow as she pressed her hand against him more closely. And then, surprising him with her swiftness, she stood and leaned over him, touching her lips to his forehead.
"Franny?"
"You're hot,"
she said, barely breathing the words.
"You're hot."
He did nothing but blink.
"You still have a fever,"
she said excitedly.
"Don't you understand? If you still have a fever, it can't be malaria."
For a moment he couldn't breathe. She was right. He couldn't believe it had not occurred to him. But she was right. The malarial fevers always disappeared by morning. They hit again the next day, of course, often with horrible force, but they always dissipated, giving him a day's respite before once again laying him low.
"It's not malaria,"
she said again, her eyes suspiciously bright.
"I told you it wasn't,"
he said, but inside he knew the truth. He hadn't been so sure.
"You're not going to die,"
she whispered, her lower lip catching in her teeth. His eyes flew to hers.
"Were you worried I would?"
he asked quietly.
"Of course I was,"
she returned, no longer trying to hide the choking sound in her voice.
"My God, Michael, I can't believe you. Do you have any idea how I... Oh, for God's sake!"
He had no idea what she'd just said, but he had a feeling it was good. She stood, the back of her chair bumping against the wall. A cloth napkin had been sitting beside the broth. She snatched it up and used it to dab at her eyes.
"Franny,"
he murmured.
"You're such a man,"
she said with a scowl. He could do nothing but raise his eyebrows at that.
"You should know, I..."
But she stopped, broke herself off.
"What is it, Franny?"
She shook her head.
Not yet,
she said, and he got the impression she was talking more to herself than to him.
Soon, but not yet.
He blinked.
I beg your pardon.
I have to go out,
she said, her words oddly curt and abrupt.
There's something I need to do.
At 8:30 in the morning.
I'll be back soon,
she said, hurrying toward the door.
Don't go anywhere.
Well, damn, he tried to joke. There go my plans to visit the king.
But Francesca was so distracted, she didn't even bother to poke at his rather pathetic attempt at humour.
Soon,
she said, the word coming out strangely like a promise.
I'll be back soon.
All he could do was shrug and watch the door as she shut it behind her.
Chapter 24
I am not certain how to tell you this, and moreover, I am not certain how the news will be received. But Michael and I were married 3 days ago. I don't know how to describe the events leading up to the marriage, except to say that it simply felt like the right thing to do. Please know that this in no way diminishes the love I felt for John. He will always hold a special and cherished place in my heart, as do you.
From the Countess of Kilmartin to the Dowager Countess of Kilmartin, 3 days after her marriage to the Earl of Kilmartin. A quarter of an hour later, Michael was feeling remarkably better. Not well, of course. Not by any stretch of the imagination could he have convinced himself, or anyone else for that matter, that he was his regular hale and hearty self. But the broth must have restored him a bit, as had the conversation, and when he got up to use the chamber pot, he found he was steadier on his legs than he would have thought. He followed this task with a bit of a makeshift bath, using a dampened cloth to wash the worst of the perspiration from his body. After donning a clean dressing gown, he felt almost human again. He started to walk back to his bed, but he just couldn't bring himself to slide his body back between those sweaty sheets. So instead he rang for a servant and sat down in his leather wing-backed chair, turning it slightly so that he might gaze out the window. It was sunny. That was a nice change. The weather had been dismal for both the weeks of his marriage. He hadn't particularly minded. When one spent as much time making love to one's wife as he had done, one didn't particularly care if the sun was shining. But now, escaping his sickbed, he found that his spirits were buoyed by the sparkle of the sunlight on the dewy grass. A movement out the window caught his eye, and he realized that it was Francesca, hurrying across the lawn. She was too far away to see clearly, but she was bundled up in her most serviceable coat and was clutching something in her hand. He leaned forward for a better look, but she disappeared from view, slipping behind a hedgerow. Just then, Reavers entered the room.
"You rang, my lord?"
Michael turned to face him.
"Yes. Could you see to having someone come and change the sheets?" "Of course, my lord. And..."
Michael had been about to ask him to have a bath drawn as well, but for some reason the following words slipped out of his mouth instead.
"Do you happen to know where Lady Kilmartin went? I saw her walking across the lawn."
Reavers shook his head.
"No, my lord. She did not see fit to confide in me, although Davies did tell me that she asked him to ask the gardener to cut her some flowers."
Michael nodded his head as he mentally followed the chain of people. He really ought to have more respect for the sheer efficiency of servants' gossip.
"Flowers, you say?"
he murmured. That must have been what she was holding as she crossed the lawn a few minutes earlier.
"Peonies,"
Reavers confirmed.
"Peonies,"
Michael echoed, leaning forward with interest. They were John's favourite bloom, and had been the centrepiece of Francesca's wedding bouquet. It was almost appalling that he remembered such a detail. But while he'd gone and gotten himself rippingly drunk, as soon as John and Francesca had departed the party, he remembered the actual ceremony with blinding detail. Her dress had been blue, ice blue, and the flowers had been peonies. They'd had to get them from a hothouse, but Francesca had insisted upon it. And suddenly He knew exactly where she was going, bundled up against the slight nip in the air. She was going to John's grave. Michael had visited the site once since his return. He'd gone alone, a few days after that extraordinary moment in his bedchamber, when he'd suddenly realized that John would have approved of his marrying Francesca. More than that, he almost thought John was up there somewhere, having a good chuckle over the whole thing. And Michael couldn't help but wonder, did Francesca realize? Did she realize that John would have wanted this? For both of them? Or was she still gripped by guilt? Michael felt himself rise from his chair. He knew guilt, knew how it ate at one's heart, tore at one's soul. He knew the pain, and he knew the way it felt like acid in one's belly. And he never wanted that for Francesca, never. She might not love him. She might not ever love him. But she was happier now than she had been before they'd married. He was sure of it. And it would kill him if she felt any shame for that happiness. John would have wanted her to be happy. He would have wanted her to love and be loved. And if Francesca somehow didn't realize that... Michael started pulling on his clothing. He might still be weak, and he might still be feverish. But by God, he could make it down to the chapel graveyard. It would half kill him, but he would not allow her to sink into the same sort of guilty despair he'd suffered for so long. She didn't have to love him. She didn't. He'd said those words to himself so many times during their brief marriage that he almost believed them. She didn't have to love him, but she did have to feel free. Free to be happy, because if she wasn't happy, well, that would kill him. He could live without her love, but not without her happiness. Francesca had known the ground would be damp, so she'd brought along a small blanket, the green and gold of the sterling plaid, making her smile wistfully as she spread it out over the grass.
"Hello, John," she said, kneeling as she carefully arranged the peonies at the base of his headstone.
His grave was a simple affair, far less ostentatious than the monuments many of the nobility erected to honour their dead. But it was what John would have wanted. She'd known him so well, been able to predict his words half the time. He would have wanted something simple, and he would have wanted it here, in the far corner of the churchyard, closer to the rolling fields of Kilmartin, his favourite place in the world. And so that was what she'd given him.
"It's a nice day," she said, sitting back on her bottom.
She hiked up her skirts so that she could sit Indian style, then carefully arranged them back over her legs. It wasn't the sort of position she could ever assume in polite company, but this was different. John would have wanted her to be comfortable.
"It's been raining for weeks," she said. "Some days worse than others, of course, but never a day without at least a few minutes of moisture. You wouldn't have minded it, but I must confess, I've been longing for the sun."
She noticed that one of the stems wasn't quite where she wanted it, so she leaned forward and reset it into place.
"Of course, it hasn't really stopped me from going out," she said with a nervous laugh. "I seem to get caught out in the rain quite a bit lately. I'm not really certain what it is. I used to be more heedful of the weather."
She sighed.
"No, I do know what it is. I'm just afraid to tell you. Silly of me, I know, but..."
She laughed again, that strained noise that sounded all wrong from her lips. It was the one thing she'd never felt around John. Nervous. From the moment they'd met, she'd felt so comfortable in his presence, so utterly at ease, both with him and herself. But now she finally had cause for nerves.
"Something has happened, John," she said, her fingers plucking at the fabric of her coat. "I started feeling something for someone that perhaps I shouldn't have done."
She looked around, half expecting some sort of divine sign from above. But there was nothing, just the gentle ruffle of wind against the leaves. She swallowed, focusing her attention back on John's headstone. It was silly that a piece of rock might come to symbolise a man, but she had no idea where else to look when she spoke to his memory.
"Maybe I shouldn't have felt it," she said. Or maybe I should have, and I just thought I shouldn't have. I don't know. All I know is, it happened. I didn't expect it, but then there it was, and with...
She stopped, her mouth curving into a smile that was almost rueful.
Well, I suppose you know who it was with. Can you imagine?
And then something remarkable happened. In retrospect, she rather thought the earth should have moved, or a shaft of light come sparkling down from the heavens across the gravesite. But there was none of that. Nothing palpable, nothing audible or visible, just an odd sense of shifting within herself, almost as if something had finally nudged itself into place. And she knew, truly, fully knew, that John could have imagined it. And more than that, he would have wanted it. He would have wanted her to marry Michael. He would have wanted her to marry any man with whom she'd fallen in love. But she rather thought he'd be almost tickled that it had happened with Michael. They were his two favourite people, and he would have liked knowing that they were together.
"I love him,"
she said, and she realised it was the first time she'd said it aloud.
"I love Michael. I do. And John,"
she touched his name, etched in the headstone.
"I think you would approve," she whispered. "Sometimes I almost think you arranged the whole thing." "It's so strange," she continued, tears now filling her eyes. "I spent so much time thinking to myself that I would never fall in love again. How could I possibly? And when anyone asked me what you would have wanted for me, of course I replied that you would wish for me to find someone else. But inside," she smiled wistfully, "inside I knew it wouldn't happen. I wasn't going to fall in love. I knew it. I absolutely knew it. So it didn't really matter what you wanted for me, did it? Except it did happen," she said softly. "It happened, and I never expected it. It happened, and it happened with Michael. I love him so much, John," she said, her voice breaking with emotion. "I kept trying to tell myself that I didn't, but when I thought he was dying, it was just too much, and I knew. God, I knew it, John. I need him. I love him. I can't live without him. And I just needed to tell you, to know that you...
She couldn't go on. There was too much inside of her, too many emotions, all desperately pushing to get out. She put her face in her hands and cried, not out of sorrow and not out of joy, but just because she couldn't keep it inside.
"John," she gasped, "I love him, and I think this is what you would have wanted. I really do, but..."
And then, from behind her, she heard a noise, a footstep, a breath. She turned, but she already knew who it would be. She could feel him in the air.
"Michael,"
she whispered, staring at him like he was a spectre. He was pale and gaunt, and had to lean on a tree for support. But to her, he looked perfect.
"Francesca,"
he said, the word awkwardly passing over his lips.
"Franny."
She rose to her feet, her eyes never leaving his.
"Did you hear me?"
she whispered.
"I love you,"
he said hoarsely.
"But did you hear me?"
she persisted. She had to know, and if he hadn't heard her, she had to tell him. He nodded jerkily.
"I love you,"
she said. She wanted to go to him. She wanted to throw her arms around him. But somehow she was rooted to her spot.
"I love you,"
she said again.
"I love you."
"You don't have to..."
"No, I do. I have to say it. I have to tell you. I love you. I do. I love you so much."
And then the distance between them was gone, and his arms came around her. She buried her face against his chest, her tears soaking his shirt. She wasn't sure why she was crying, but she didn't really care. All she wanted was the warmth of his embrace. In his arms she could feel the future, and it was wonderful. Michael's chin came to rest on her head.
"I didn't mean that you didn't need to say it," he murmured, "just that you didn't have to repeat it."
She laughed at that, even as the tears kept flowing, and both of their bodies shook.
"You have to say it," he said. "If you feel it, then you have to say it. I'm a greedy bastard, and I want it all."
She looked up at him, her eyes bright.
"I love you."
Michael touched her cheek.
"I have no idea what I did to deserve you," he said.
"You didn't have to do anything," she whispered. "You just had to be."
She reached up and touched his cheek, the gesture a perfect mirror of his own.
"It just took me a while to realize it, that's all."
He turned his face into her hand, then brought both of his up to cover it. He pressed a kiss against her palm, stopping just to inhale the scent of her skin. He'd tried so hard to convince himself that it didn't matter if she loved him, that having her as his wife was enough. But now that she'd said it, now that he knew, now that his heart had soared, he knew better. This was heaven. This was bliss. This was something he'd never dared hope to feel, something he never could have dreamed existed. This was love.
"For the rest of my life," he vowed, "I will love you. For the rest of my life, I promise you, I will lay down my life for you. I will honour and cherish you. I will..."
He was choking on the words, but he didn't care. He just wanted to tell her. He just wanted her to know.
"Let's go home," she said softly.
He nodded. She took his hand, gently pulling him away from the clearing, back toward the wooded area that lay between the churchyard and Kilmartin. Michael leaned into her tug, but before his feet lifted from the earth, he turned back towards John's grave and mouthed the words, "Thank you." And then he let his wife lead him home.
"I wanted to tell you later," she was saying.
Her voice was still shaky with emotion, but she was starting to sound a bit more like her usual self.
"I'd planned a big romantic gesture. Something huge. Something..."
She turned to him, offering him a rueful smile.
"Well, I don't know what, but it would have been grand."
He just shook his head.
"I don't need that," he said. "All I need... I just need..."
And it didn't matter that he didn't know how to finish the sentence, because somehow she knew anyway.
"I know," she whispered. "I need the exact same thing."
Epilogue.
"My dear nephew, although Helen insists that she was not surprised at the announcement of your marriage to Francesca, I shall own up to a less clever imagination, and confess that to me it came as a complete shock. I implore you, however, not to confuse shock with lack of acceptance. It did not require much time, or thought, to realize that you and Francesca are an ideal match. I don't know how I did not see it before. I do not profess to understand metaphysics, and in truth, I rarely have patience for those who claim that they do. But there is an understanding between the two of you, a meeting of the minds and souls that exists on a higher plane. You were, it is clear, born for each other. These are not easy words for me to write. John still lives on in my heart, and I feel his presence every day. I mourn my son, and I shall always do so. I cannot tell you what comfort it gives me to know that you and Francesca feel the same. I hope you will not think me self-important when I offer you my blessing, and I hope you will not think me foolish when I also extend my thanks. Thank you, Michael, for letting my son love her first."
From Janet Stirling, Dowager Countess of Kilmartin, to Michael Stirling, Earl of Kilmartin, June 1824.
Dear reader, have you ever wondered what happened to your favourite characters after you closed the final page? Wanted just a little bit more of a favourite novel? I have, and if the questions from my readers are any indication, I'm not the only one.
So, after countless requests from Bridgerton fans, I decided to try something a little different, and I wrote a second epilogue for each of the novels. These are the stories that come after the stories. At first, the Bridgerton second epilogues were available exclusively online. Later they were published, along with a novella about Violet Bridgerton, in a collection called The Bridgertons, Happily Ever After. Now, for the first time, each second epilogue is being included with the novel it follows. I hope you enjoy Michael and Francesca as they continue their journey. Warmly, Julia Quinn. When He Was Wicked, the second epilogue. She was counting again, counting, always counting. 7 days since her last menses, 6 until she might be fertile, 24 to 31 until she might expect to bleed again, provided she didn't conceive, which she probably wouldn't. It had been 3 years since she'd married Michael. 3 years. She'd suffered through her courses 33 times. She'd counted them, of course, made depressing little hatch marks on a piece of paper she kept tucked away in her desk, in the far back corner of the middle drawer, where Michael wouldn't see. It would pain him, not because he wanted a child, which she did, but rather because she wanted one so desperately. And he wanted it for her, maybe even more than he wanted one himself. She tried to hide her sorrow. She tried to smile at the breakfast table and pretend that it didn't matter that she'd a wad of cloth between her legs. But Michael always saw it in her eyes, and he seemed to hold her closer through the day, kiss her brow more often. She tried to tell herself that she should count her blessings. And she did. Oh, how she did. Every day. She was Francesca Bridgerton Stirling, Countess of Kilmartin, blessed with 2 loving families, the one she'd been born into, and the one she'd acquired twice through marriage. She had a husband most women only dreamed of, handsome, funny, intelligent, and as desperately in love with her as she was with him. Michael made her laugh. He made her days a joy and her nights an adventure. She loved to talk with him, to walk with him, to simply sit in the same room with him and steal glances while they were each pretending to read a book. She was happy. Truly she was. And if she never had a baby, at least she had this man, this wonderful, marvellous, miraculous man who understood her in a way that left her breathless. He knew her. He knew every inch of her. And still he never ceased to amaze and challenge her. She loved him. With every breath in her body, she loved him. And most of the time, it was enough. Most of the time, it was more than enough. But late at night, after he'd fallen asleep, and she still lay awake, curled up against him, she felt an emptiness that she feared neither of them could ever fill. She would touch her abdomen, and there it was, flat as always, mocking her with its refusal to do the one thing she wanted more than anything else. And that was when she cried. There had to be a name for it, Michael thought, as he stood at his window, watching Francesca disappear over the hillside toward the Kilmartin family plot. There had to be a name for this particular brand of pain, of torture, really. All he wanted in the world was to make her happy. Oh, for certain there were other things. Peace, health, prosperity for his tenants, right-minded men in the seat of Prime Minister for the next 100 years. But when all was said and done, what he wanted was Francesca's happiness. He loved her. He always had. It was, or at least it should have been, the most uncomplicated thing in the world. He loved her. Period. And he would have moved heaven and earth, if it were only in his power, to make her happy. Except the one thing she wanted most of all, the one thing she craved so desperately and fought so valiantly to hide her pain about, he could not seem to give her. A child. And the funny thing was, he was beginning to feel the same pain, At first, he had felt it just for her. She wanted a child, and therefore he wanted one as well. She wanted to be a mother, and therefore he wanted her to be one. He wanted to see her holding a child, not because it would be his child, but because it would be hers. He wanted her to have what she desired, and selfishly, he wanted to be the man to give it to her. But lately, he'd felt the pangs himself. They would visit one of her many brothers or sisters and be immediately surrounded by the next generation of offspring. They would tug on his leg, shriek, "Uncle Michael!" and howl with laughter when he would toss them in the air, always begging for one more minute, one more twirl, one more secret peppermint candy. The Bridgertons were marvellously fertile. They all seemed to produce exactly the number of offspring they desired, and then perhaps one more, just for good measure. Except Francesca. 584 days later, Francesca stepped out of the Kilmartin carriage and breathed the fresh, clean air of the Kent countryside. Spring was well underway, and the sun was warm on her cheeks, but when the wind blew, it carried with it the last hints of winter. Francesca didn't mind, though. She'd always liked the tingle of a cold wind on her skin. It drove Michael mad. He was always complaining that he'd never quite readjusted to life in a cold climate after so many years in India. She was sorry he had not been able to accompany her on the long ride down from Scotland for the christening of Hyacinth's baby daughter, Isabella. He would be there, of course. She and Michael never missed the christening of any of their nieces and nephews. But affairs in Edinburgh had delayed his arrival. Francesca could have delayed her trip as well, but it had been many months since she had seen her family, and she missed them. It was funny. When she was younger, she'd always been so eager to get away, to set up her own household, her own identity. But now, as she watched her nieces and nephews grow, she found herself visiting more often. She didn't want to miss the milestones. She had just happened to be visiting when Colin's daughter, Agatha, had taken her first steps. It had been breathtaking, and although she had wept quietly in her bed that night, the tears in her eyes as she'd watched Aggie lurch forward and laugh had been ones of pure joy. If she wasn't going to be a mother, then, by God, at least she would have those moments. She couldn't bear to think of life without them. Francesca smiled as she handed her cloak to a footman and walked down the familiar corridors of Aubrey Hall. She'd spent much of her childhood here, and at Bridgerton House in London. Anthony and his wife had made some changes, but much was still just as it had always been. The walls were still painted the same creamy white, with the barest undertone of peach, and the Fragonard her father had bought her mother for her 30th birthday still hung over the table just outside the door to the Rose Salon. "Francesca!" She turned. It was her mother, rising from her seat in the salon. "How long have you been standing out there?" Violet asked, coming to greet her. Francesca embraced her mother. "Not long. I was admiring the painting." Violet stood beside her, and together they regarded the Fragonard. "It's marvellous, isn't it?" she murmured, a soft, wistful smile touching her face. "I love it," Francesca said. "I always have. It makes me think of father." Violet turned to her in surprise. "It does?" Francesca could understand her reaction. The painting was of a young woman holding a bouquet of flowers with a note attached. Not a very masculine subject, but she was looking over her shoulder, and her expression was a little bit mischievous, as if, given the correct provocation, she might laugh. Francesca could not remember much of her parents' relationship. She had been but 6 at the time of her father's death. But she remembered the laughter, the sound of her father's deep, rich chuckle. It lived within her. "I think your marriage must have been like that," Francesca said, motioning to the painting. Violet took a half step back and cocked her head to the side. "I think you're right," she said, looking rather delighted by the realization. I never thought of it quite that way.
You should take the painting back with you to London, Francesca said. It's yours, isn't it?
Violet blushed, and for a brief moment Francesca saw the young girl she must have been shining out from her eyes. Yes, she said, but it belongs here. This was where he gave it to me. And this, she motioned to its spot of honour on the wall, was where we hung it together.
You were very happy,
Francesca said. It wasn't a question, just an observation.
As are you.
Francesca nodded. Violet reached out and took her hand, patting it gently, as they both continued to study the painting. Francesca knew exactly what her mother was thinking about, her infertility, and the fact that they seemed to have unspoken agreement never to talk about it. And really, why should they? What could Violet possibly say that would make it better? Francesca couldn't say anything, because that would just make her mother feel even worse. And so instead they stood there as they always did, thinking the same thing but never speaking of it, wondering which of them hurt more. Francesca thought it might be her. Hers was the barren womb after all. But maybe her mother's pain was more acute. Violet was her mother, and she was grieving for the lost dreams of her child. Wouldn't that be painful? And the irony was, Francesca would never know. She'd never know what it felt like to hurt for a child, because she'd never know what it was to be a mother. She was almost 33. She did not know any married lady who had reached that age without conceiving a child. It seemed that children either arrived right away or not at all.
"Has Hyacinth arrived?"
Francesca asked, still looking at the painting, still staring at the twinkle in the woman's eye.
"Not yet, but Eloise will be here later this afternoon. She..."
But Francesca heard the catch in her mother's voice before she'd cut herself off.
"Is she expecting, then?"
she asked. There was a beat of silence, and then...
"Yes, that's wonderful."
And she meant it. She did, with every last bit of her being. She just didn't know how to make it sound that way. She didn't want to look at her mother's face, because then she would cry. Francesca cleared her throat, tilting her head to the side, as if there were an inch of the Fragonard she hadn't yet perused.
"Anyone else?" she queried.
She felt her mother stiffen slightly beside her, and she wondered if Violet was deciding whether it was worth it to pretend that she didn't know exactly what she meant.
"Lucy,"
her mother said quietly. Francesca finally turned and faced Violet, pulling her hand out of her mother's grasp.
"Again?"
she asked. Lucy and Gregory had been married for less than 2 years, but this would be their second child. Violet nodded.
"I'm sorry." "Don't say that,"
Francesca said, horrified by how thick her voice sounded.
"Don't say you're sorry. It's not something to be sorry about."
"No," her mother said quickly.
"That wasn't what I meant. You should be delighted for them."
"I am.
More delighted for them than you were sorry for me,"
Francesca choked out.
"Francesca."
Violet tried to reach for her, but Francesca pulled away.
"Promise me," she said. "You have to promise me that you will always be more happy than you are sorry."
Violet looked at her helplessly, and Francesca realized that her mother did not know what to say. For her entire life, Violet Bridgerton had been the most sensitive and wonderful of mothers. She always seemed to know what her children needed, exactly when they needed it, whether it was a kind word or a gentle prod, or even a giant proverbial kick in the britches. But now, in this moment, Violet was lost, and Francesca was the one who had done it to her.
"I'm sorry, Mother," she said, the words spilling out. "I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry."
"No." Violet rushed forward to embrace her, and this time Francesca did not pull away.
"No, darling,"
Violet said again, softly stroking her hair.
"Don't say that. Please don't say that."
She shushed and she crooned,
and Francesca let her mother hold her. And when Francesca's hot, silent tears fell on her mother's shoulder, neither one of them said a word. By the time Michael arrived 2 days later, Francesca had thrown herself into the preparations for little Isabella's christening, and her conversation with her mother was, if not forgotten, at least not at the forefront of her mind. It wasn't as if any of this was new, after all. Francesca was just as barren as she'd been every time she came to England to see her family. The only difference this time was that she'd actually talked to someone about it. A little bit. As much as she was able. And yet, somehow, something had been lifted from her. When she'd stood there in the hall, her mother's arms around her, something had poured out from her, along with her tears. And while she still grieved for the babies she would never have, for the first time in a long time, she felt unreservedly happy. It was strange and wonderful, and she positively refused to question it.
"Aunt Francesca! Aunt Francesca!"
Francesca smiled as she looped her arm through that of her niece. Charlotte was Antony's youngest, due to turn 8 in a month's time.
"What is it, Bobbit? Did you see the baby's dress? It's so long."
"I know."
"And frilly."
"Christening dresses are meant to be frilly. Even the boys are covered in lace."
"It seems a waste,"
Charlotte said with a shrug.
"Isabella doesn't know she's wearing anything so pretty."
"Ah, but we do."
Charlotte pondered this for a moment.
"But I don't care. Do you?"
Francesca chuckled.
"No, I don't suppose I do. I should love her no matter what she was wearing."
The two of them continued their stroll through the gardens, picking the grape hyacinths to decorate the chapel. They had nearly filled the basket when they heard the unmistakable sound of a carriage coming down the drive.
"I wonder who it is now,"
Charlotte said, rising to her toes, as if that might actually help her see the carriage any better.
"I'm not sure,"
Francesca replied. Any number of relations were due that afternoon.
"Uncle Michael, maybe."
Francesca smiled.
"I hope so."
"I adore Uncle Michael,"
Charlotte said with a sigh, and Francesca almost laughed, because the look in her niece's eyes was one she'd seen 1,000 times before. Women adored Michael. It seemed even 7-year-old girls were not immune to his charm.
"Well, he is very handsome,"
Francesca demurred. Charlotte shrugged.
"I suppose."
"You suppose?"
Francesca replied, trying very hard not to smile.
"I like him because he tosses me in the air when Father isn't looking."
"He does like to bend the rules,"
Charlotte grinned.
"I know. It's why I don't tell Father."
Francesca had never thought of Antony as particularly stern, but he had been the head of the family for over 20 years, and she supposed the experience had endowed him with a certain love of order and tidiness. And it had to be said, he did like to be in charge.
"It shall be our secret,"
Francesca said, leaning down to whisper in her niece's ear.
"And any time you wish to come visit us in Scotland, you may. We bend rules all the time."
Charlotte's eyes grew huge.
"You do?
Sometimes we have breakfast for supper."
"Brilliant!"
"And we walk in the rain."
Charlotte shrugged.
"Everybody walks in the rain."
"Yes, I suppose. But sometimes we dance."
Charlotte stepped back.
"May I go back with you now?"
"That's up to your parents, Poppet."
Francesca laughed and reached for Charlotte's hand.
"But we can dance right now."
"Here?"
Francesca nodded.
"Where everyone can see?"
Francesca looked around.
"I don't see anyone watching. And even if there were, who cares?"
Charlotte's lips pursed, and Francesca could practically see her mind at work.
"Not me,"
she announced, and she linked her arm through Francesca's. Together they did a little jig, followed by a Scottish reel, twisting and twirling until they were both breathless.
"I wish it would rain,"
Charlotte laughed.
"Now what would be the fun in that?" came a new voice.
"Uncle Michael!"
Charlotte shrieked, launching herself at him. "And I am instantly forgotten," Francesca said with a wry smile. Michael looked at her warmly over Charlotte's head. "Not by me," he murmured.
"Aunt Francesca and I have been dancing,"
Charlotte told him. "I know. I saw you from inside the house. I especially enjoyed the new one."
"What new one?"
Michael pretended to look confused. "The new dance you were doing."
"We weren't doing any new dances,"
Charlotte replied, her brows knitting together. "Then what was that one that involved throwing yourself on the grass?" Francesca bit her lip to keep from smiling.
"We fell, Uncle Michael."
"No."
"We did."
"It was a vigorous dance," Francesca confirmed.
"You must be exceptionally graceful, then, because it looked completely as if you'd done it on purpose."
"We didn't, we didn't!"
Charlotte said excitedly.
"We really did just fall. By accident."
"I suppose I will believe you," he said with a sigh. "But only because I know you are far too trustworthy to lie."
She looked him in the eye with a melting expression.
"I would never lie to you, Uncle Michael," she said.
He kissed her cheek and set her down.
"Your mother says it's time for dinner."
"But you just got here."
"I'm not going anywhere. You need your sustenance after all the dancing."
"I'm not hungry,"
she offered.
"Pity then," he said, "because I was going to teach you to waltz this afternoon, and you certainly cannot do that on an empty stomach."
Charlotte's eyes grew to near circles.
"Really? Father said I cannot learn until I am 10.
Michael gave her one of those devastating half-smiles that still made Francesca tingle.
"We don't have to tell him, do we?"
"Oh, Uncle Michael, I love you,"
she said fervently. And then, after one extremely vigorous hug, Charlotte ran off to Aubrey Hall.
"And another one falls," Francesca said with a shake of her head, watching her niece dash across the fields.
Michael took her hand and tugged her toward him.
"What is that supposed to mean?"
Francesca grinned a little and sighed a little, and said,
"I would never lie to you."
He kissed her soundly.
"I certainly hope not."
She looked up into his silvery eyes and let herself ease against the warmth of his body.
"It seems no woman is immune."
"How lucky I am, then, that I fall under the spell of only one."
"Lucky for me."
"Well, yes," he said with affected modesty, "but I wasn't going to say it."
She swatted him on the arm. He kissed her in return.
"I missed you."
"I missed you too."
"And how is the Clan Bridgerton?" he asked, linking his arm through hers.
"Rather wonderful," Francesca replied. "I am having a splendid time, actually."
"Actually?"
he echoed, looking vaguely amused. Francesca steered him away from the house. It had been over a week since she'd had his company, and she didn't wish to share him just then.
"What do you mean?"
she asked.
"You said, actually, as if you were surprised."
"Of course not," she said. But then she thought. "I always have a lovely time when I visit my family," she said carefully.
"But?"
"But it's better this time,"
she shrugged.
"I don't know why."
Which wasn't precisely the truth. That moment with her mother, there had been magic in those tears. But she couldn't tell him that. He'd hear the bit about crying and nothing else, and then he'd worry, and she'd feel terrible for worrying him, and she was tired of all that. Besides, he was a man. He'd never understand anyway.
"I feel happy,"
she announced.
"Something in the air."
"The sun is shining,"
he observed. She gave him a jaunty, single-shouldered shrug and leaned back against a tree.
"Birds are singing."
"Flowers blooming?"
"Just a few," she admitted.
He regarded the landscape.
"All the moment needs is a cherubic little bunny hopping across the field."
She smiled blissfully and leaned into him for a kiss.
"Bucolic splendour is a marvellous thing."
"Indeed."
His lips found hers with familiar hunger.
"I missed you,"
he said, his voice husky with desire. She let out a little moan as he nipped her ear.
I know. You said that.
It bears repeating.
Francesca meant to say something witty about never tiring of hearing it, but at that moment she found herself pressed rather breathlessly against the tree, one of her legs lifted up around his hips.
You wear far too many clothes, he growled.
We're a little too close to the house, she gasped,
her belly clenching with need as he pressed more intimately against her.
How far,
he murmured, one of his hands stealing under her skirts,
is not too close.
Not far?
He drew back and gazed at her.
Really?
Really?
Her lips curved, and she felt devilish. She felt powerful, and she wanted to take charge of him, of her life, of everything.
Come with me,
she said impulsively, and she grabbed his hand and ran. Michael had missed his wife. At night, when she was not beside him, the bed felt cold, and the air felt empty. Even when he was tired, and his body was not hungry for her, he craved her presence, her scent, her warmth. He missed the sound of her breathing. He missed the way the mattress moved differently when there was a second body on it. He knew, even though she was more reticent than he, and far less likely to use such passionate words, that she felt the same way. But even so, he was pleasantly surprised to be racing across a field, letting her take the lead, knowing that in a few short minutes he would be buried deep within her.
Here,
she said, skidding to a halt at the bottom of a hill. Here, he asked dubiously. There was no cover of trees, nothing to block them from sight should anyone stroll by. She sat.
No one comes this way.
No one?
The grass is very soft,
she said seductively, patting a spot beside her.
I'm not even going to ask how you know that,
he muttered.
Picnics,
she said, her expression delightfully outraged.
With my dolls.
He took off his coat and laid it like a blanket on the grass. The ground was softly sloped, which he would imagine would be more comfortable for her than horizontal. He looked at her. He looked at the coat. She didn't move.
You,
she said.
Me?
Lie down, she ordered.
He did, with alacrity. And then, before he'd had time to make a comment, to tease or cajole, or even really to breathe, she'd straddled him.
Oh, dear,
he gasped. But he couldn't finish. She was kissing him now, her mouth hot and hungry and aggressive. It was all deliciously familiar. He loved knowing every little bit of her, from the slope of her breast to the rhythm of her kisses. And yet, this time, she felt a little new, renewed. One of his hands moved to the back of her head. At home, he liked to pull the pins out one by one, watching each lock tumble from her coiffure. But today he was too needy, too urgent. And he didn't have patience for...
What was that for?
He asked. She had yanked his hand away. Her eyes narrowed languidly.
I'm in charge, she whispered.
His body tightened.
More? Dear God, she was going to kill him. Don't go slow,
he gasped. But he didn't think she was listening. She was taking her time, undoing his breeches, letting her hands flutter along his belly until she found him.
Franny.
One finger. That's all she gave him. One feather-light finger along his shaft. She turned, looked at him.
This is fun,
she remarked. He just focused on trying to breathe.
I love you,
she said softly, and he felt her rise. She hoisted her skirts to her thighs as she positioned herself. And then, with one spectacularly swift stroke, she took him within her, her body coming to rest against his, leaving him embedded to the hilt. He wanted to move then. He wanted to thrust up or flip her over and pound until they were both nothing but dust. But her hands were firm on his hips, and when he looked up at her, her eyes were closed.
and she almost looked as if she were concentrating. Her breathing was slow and steady, but it was loud too, and with each exhale she seemed to bear down on him just a little bit heavier.
"Franny!"
he groaned, because he didn't know what else to do. He wanted her to move faster, or harder, or something, but all she did was rock back and forth, her hips arching and curving in delicious torment. He clutched her hips, intending to move her up and down, but she opened her eyes and shook her head with a soft, blissful smile.
"I like it this way," she said.
He wanted something different. He needed something different. But when she looked down at him, she looked so damned happy that he could deny her nothing. And then, sure enough, she began to shudder. And it was strange, because he knew the feel of her climax so well, and yet this time it seemed softer, and stronger at the same time. She swayed, and she rocked, and then she let out a little scream and sagged against him. And then, to his utter and complete surprise, he came. He hadn't thought he was ready. He hadn't thought he was remotely near climax. Not that it would have taken long had he been able to move beneath her. But then, without warning, he had simply exploded. They lay that way for some time, the sun falling gently on them. She burrowed her face in his neck, and he held her, wondering how it was possible that such moments existed. Because it was perfect, and he would have stayed there forever, had he been able. And even though he didn't ask her, he knew she felt the same. They'd meant to go home 2 days after the christening, Francesca thought, as she watched one of her nephews tackle the other to the ground. But here it was, 3 weeks out, and they had not even begun to pack.
"No broken bones, I hope?"
Francesca smiled up at her sister Eloise, who had also elected to stay on at Aubrey Hall for an extended visit.
"No,"
she answered, wincing slightly when the future Duke of Hastings, otherwise known as Davy, aged 11, let out a war whoop as he jumped from a tree.
"But it's not for lack of trying."
Eloise took a seat beside her and tilted her face to the sun.
"I'll put my bonnet on in a minute, I swear it," she said.
"I can't quite determine the rules of the game," Francesca remarked.
Eloise didn't bother to open her eyes.
"That's because there are none."
Francesca watched the chaos with fresh perspective. Oliver, Eloise's 12-year-old stepson, had grabbed hold of a ball. Since when had there been a ball? And was racing across the lawn. He appeared to reach his goal. Not that Francesca would ever be sure whether that was the giant oak stump that had been there since she was a child, or Miles, Anthony's second son, who had been sitting cross-legged and cross-armed since Francesca had come outside 10 minutes earlier. But whichever was the case, Oliver must have won a point, because he slammed the ball against the ground and then jumped up and down with a triumphant cry. Miles must have been on his team. This was the first indication Francesca had that there were teams, because he hopped to his feet and celebrated in kind. Eloise opened one eye.
"My child didn't kill anyone, did he?"
"No."
"No one killed him?"
Francesca smiled.
"No."
"Good."
Eloise yawned and resettled into her chaise. Francesca thought about her words.
"Eloise?"
"Hmm?"
"Do you ever..."
She frowned. There really wasn't any right way to ask this.
"Do you ever love Oliver and Amanda?"
"Less?"
Eloise supplied.
"Yes."
Eloise sat up straighter and opened her eyes.
"No."
"Really?"
It wasn't that Francesca didn't believe her. She loved her nieces and nephews with every breath in her body. She would have laid down her life for any one of them, Oliver and Amanda included, without even a moment's hesitation. But she hadn't ever given birth. She had never carried a child in her womb. Not for long, anyway, and didn't know if somehow that made it different, made it more. If she had a baby, one of her own, born of her blood and Michael's,
would she suddenly realise that this love she felt now for Charlotte and Oliver and Miles and all the others, would it suddenly feel like a wisp next to what was in her heart for her own child? Did it make a difference? Did she want it to make a difference? I thought it would, Eloise admitted. Of course, I loved Oliver and Amanda long before I had Penelope. How could I not? They are pieces of Philip. And, she continued, her face growing thoughtful, as if she had never quite delved into this before, they are themselves, and I am their mother. Francesca smiled wistfully. But even so, Eloise continued, before I had Penelope, and even when I was carrying her, I thought it would be different. She paused. It is different. She paused again. But it's not less. It's not a question of levels or amounts or even, really, the nature of it. Eloise shrugged. I can't explain it. Francesca looked back to the game, which had resumed with new intensity. No, she said softly. I think you did. There was a long silence, and then Eloise said, You don't talk about it much. Francesca shook her head gently. No. Do you want to? She thought about that for a moment. I don't know. She turned to her sister. They had been at sixes and sevens for much of their childhood, but in so many ways Eloise was like the other half of her coin. They looked so alike, save for the colour of their eyes, and they even shared the same birthday, just 1 year apart. Eloise was watching her with a tender curiosity, a sympathy that just a few weeks ago would have been heartbreaking. But now it was simply comforting. Francesca didn't feel pitied. She felt loved. I'm happy, Francesca said, and she was. She really was. For once, she didn't feel that aching emptiness hiding underneath. She'd even forgotten to count. She didn't know how many days it had been since her last menses, and it felt so bloody good. I hate numbers, she muttered. I beg your pardon. She bit back a smile. Nothing. The sun, which had been obscured behind a thin layer of cloud, suddenly popped into the open. Eloise shaded her eyes with her hand as she sat back. Good heavens, she remarked. I think Oliver just sat on Miles. Francesca laughed, and then, before she even knew what she was about, stood. Do you think they'll let me play? Eloise looked at her as if she'd gone mad, which Francesca thought with a shrug. Perhaps she had. Eloise looked at Francesca, and then at the boys, and then back at Francesca. And then she stood. If you do it, I'll do it. You can't do it, Francesca said. You're pregnant. Barely, Eloise said with a scoff. Besides, Oliver wouldn't dare sit on me. She held out her arm. Shall we? I believe we shall. Francesca linked her arm through her sister's, and together they ran down the hill, shouting like banshees and loving every minute of it.
I heard you made quite a scene this afternoon, Michael said, perching on the edge of the bed.
Francesca did not move, not even an eyelid. I'm exhausted, was all she said. He took in the dusty hem of her dress.
And dirty, too.
Too tired to wash.
Anthony said that Miles said that he was quite impressed. Apparently you throw quite well for a girl.
It would have been brilliant, she replied, had I been informed that I wasn't meant to use my hands.
He chuckled. What game exactly were you playing?
I have no idea.
She let out an exhausted little moan.
Would you rub my feet?
He pushed himself farther onto the bed and slid her dress up to mid-calf. Her feet were filthy.
Good Lord, he exclaimed. Did you go barefoot?
I couldn't very well play in my slippers.
How did Eloise fare?
She, apparently, throws like a boy.
I thought you weren't meant to use your hands.
At that, she pushed herself indignantly up on her elbows.
I know. It depended on what end of the field one was at. Whoever heard of such a thing?
He took her foot in his hands, making a mental note to wash them later. His hands, that was. She could take care of her own feet.
I had no idea you were so competitive, he remarked.
It runs in the family, she mumbled. No, no. There. Yes. Oh, right there. Harder. Oh.
Why do I feel as if I heard this before? He mused. Except that I was having much more fun.
Just be quiet and keep rubbing my feet.
At your service, Your Majesty, he murmured, smiling when she realized she was perfectly content to be referred to as such. After a minute or two of silence, save for the occasional moan from Francesca, he asked, How much longer do you wish to stay?
Are you eager to return home?
I do have matters to attend to, he replied, but nothing that cannot wait. I'm rather enjoying your family, actually.
She quirked a brow and a smile.
Actually?
Indeed. Although it was a bit daunting when your sister beat me at the shooting match.
She beats everyone. She always has. Shoot with Gregory next time. He can't hit a tree.
Michael moved on to the other foot. Francesca looked so happy and relaxed. Not just now, but at the supper table, and in the drawing room, and when she was chasing her nieces and nephews, and even at night, when he was making love to her in their huge four-poster bed. He was ready to go home, back to Kilmartin, which was ancient and draughty, but indelibly theirs. But he'd happily remain here forever, if it meant Francesca would always look like this.
"I think you're right," she said.
"Of course," he replied. "But about what exactly?"
"It's time to go home."
"I didn't say that it was. I merely inquired as to your intentions."
"You didn't have to say it," she said.
"If you want to stay," she shook her head.
"I don't. I want to go home. Our home."
With a stiff groan, she sat up all the way, curling her legs beneath her.
"This has been lovely, and I have had such a wonderful time, but I miss Kilmartin."
"Are you certain?"
"I miss you."
He lifted his brows.
"I'm right here."
She smiled and leaned forward.
"I miss having you to myself."
"You need only say the word, my lady. Any time, anywhere. I'll whisk you off and let you have your way with me."
She chuckled.
"Perhaps right now."
He thought that was an excellent idea, but chivalry forced him to say,
"I thought you were sore."
"Not that sore. Not if you do all the work."
"That, my dear, is not a problem."
He pulled his shirt over his head and lay down beside her, giving her a long, delicious kiss. He pulled back with a contented sigh and then just gazed at her.
"You're beautiful," he whispered. "More than ever."
She smiled, that lazy, warm smile that meant she'd been recently pleasured, or knew she was about to be. He loved that smile. He went to work on the buttons at the back of her frock and was halfway down when all of a sudden a thought popped into his head.
"Wait," he said. "Can you?"
"Can I what?"
He stopped, frowning as he tried to count it out in his head. Oughtn't she be bleeding?
"Isn't it your time?" he asked.
Her lips parted and she blinked.
"No,"
she said, sounding a little bit startled, not by his question but by her answer.
"No, I'm not."
He shifted position, moving back a few inches so that he could better see her face.
"Do you think..."
"I don't know."
She was blinking rapidly now, and he could hear that her breathing had grown more rapid.
"I suppose I could..."
He wanted to whoop with joy, but he dared not. Not yet.
When do you think?
I'll know. I don't know. Maybe...
In a month? Two?
Maybe two. Maybe sooner. I don't know.
Her hand flew to her belly.
It might not take.
It might not,
he said carefully.
But it might.
It might.
He felt laughter bubbling within him, a strange giddiness in his belly, growing and tickling until it burst from his lips.
We can't be sure,
she warned, but he could see that she was excited too. No, he said, but somehow he knew they were.
I don't want to get my hopes up.
No, no, of course we mustn't.
Her eyes grew wide, and she placed both hands on her belly, still absolutely, completely flat.
Do you feel anything?
He whispered. She shook her head.
It would be too early anyway.
He knew that. He knew that he knew that. He didn't know why he'd asked. And then Francesca said the damnedest thing.
But he's there,
she whispered.
I know it.
Franny, if she was wrong, if her heart was broken again, he just didn't think he could bear it. But she was shaking her head.
It's true,
she said, and she wasn't insisting. She wasn't trying to convince him, or even herself. He could hear it in her voice. Somehow she knew.
Have you been feeling ill? He asked.
She shook her head.
Have you... Good God, you shouldn't have been playing with the boys this afternoon.
Eloise did.
Eloise can do what she damned well pleases. She isn't you.
She smiled. Like a Madonna, she smiled. He would have sworn it. And she said,
I won't break.
He remembered when she'd miscarried years ago. It had not been his child, but he had felt her pain, hot and searing, like a fist around his heart. His cousin, her first husband, had been dead a scant few weeks, and they were both reeling from that loss. When she'd lost John's baby, he didn't think either one of them could survive another loss like that.
Francesca, he said urgently, you must take care, please.
It won't happen again, she said, shaking her head.
How do you know?
She gave him a bewildered shrug.
I don't know. I just do.
Dear God, he prayed she was not deluding herself.
Do you want to tell your family?
He asked quietly. She shook her head.
Not yet. Not because I have any fears,
she hastened to add.
I just want...
Her lips pressed together in the most adorably giddy little smile.
I just want it to be mine for a little while. Ours.
He brought her hand to his lips.
How long is a little while?
I'm not sure.
But her eyes were growing crafty.
I'm not quite sure.
1 year later. Violet Bridgerton loved all her children equally, but she loved them differently as well. And when it came to missing them, she did so in what she considered a most logical manner. Her heart pined the most for the one she'd seen the least. And that was why, as she waited in the drawing room at Aubrey Hall, waiting for a carriage bearing the Kilmartin crest to roll down the drive, she found herself fidgety and eager, jumping up every 5 minutes to watch through the window.
She wrote that they would arrive today,
Kate reassured her. I know, Violet replied with a sheepish smile. It's just that I haven't seen her for an entire year.
I know Scotland is far, but I've never gone an entire year without seeing one of my children before.
Really?
Kate asked.
That's remarkable. We all have our priorities,
Violet said, deciding there was no point in trying to pretend she wasn't jumping at the bit. She set down her embroidery and moved to the window, craning her neck, when she thought she saw something glinting in the sunlight.
Even when Colin was travelling so much?
Kate asked.
The longest he was gone was 342 days,
Violet replied.
When he was travelling in the Mediterranean,
You counted. Violet shrugged. I can't help myself. I like to count.
She thought of all the counting she'd done when her children were growing up, making sure she had as many offspring at the end of an outing as she'd had at the beginning. It helps to keep track of things. Kate smiled as she reached down and rocked the cradle at her feet.
I shall never complain about the logistics of managing four.
Violet crossed the room to peek down at her newest grandchild. Little Mary had been a bit of a surprise, coming so many years after Charlotte. Kate had thought herself done with childbearing. But then, 10 months earlier, she'd got out of bed, walked calmly to the chamber pot, emptied the contents of her stomach, and announced to Anthony,
"I believe we're expecting again."
Or so they'd told Violet. She made it a point to stay out of her grown children's bedrooms, except in the case of illness or childbirth.
"I never complained," Violet said softly.
Kate didn't hear, but Violet hadn't meant her to. She smiled down at Mary, sleeping sweetly under a purple blanket.
"I think your mother would have been delighted," she said, looking up at Kate.
Kate nodded, her eyes misting over. Her mother, actually her stepmother, but Mary Sheffield had raised her from a little girl, had passed away a month before Kate realized that she was pregnant.
"I know it makes no sense," Kate said,
leaning down to examine her child's face more closely,
"but I would swear she looks a bit like her."
Violet blinked and tilted her head to the side.
"I think you're right. Something about the eyes."
"No, it's the nose."
"Do you think?" "I rather thought." "Oh, look!"
Kate pointed toward the window.
"Is that Francesca?"
Violet straightened and rushed to the window.
"It is," she exclaimed. "Oh, and the sun is shining. I'm going to wait outside."
With nary a backward glance, she grabbed her shawl off a side table and dashed into the hall. It had been so long since she'd seen Franny, but that wasn't the only reason she was so eager to see her. Francesca had changed during her last visit, back at Isabella's christening. It was hard to explain, but Violet had sensed that something had shifted within her. Of all her children, Francesca had always been the most quiet, the most private. She loved her family, but she also loved being apart from them, forging her own identity, making her own life. It was not surprising that she had never chosen to share her feelings about the most painful corner of her life, her infertility. But last time, even though they had not spoken about it explicitly, something had still passed within them, and Violet had almost felt as if she'd been able to absorb some of her grief. When Francesca had departed, the clouds behind her eyes had been lifted. Violet didn't know whether she had finally accepted her fate, or whether she had simply learned how to rejoice in what she had. But Francesca had seemed, for the first time in Violet's recent memory, unreservedly happy. Violet ran through the hall, really at her age, and pushed open the front door so that she could wait in the drive. Francesca's carriage was nearly there, starting the final turn so that one of the doors would be facing the house. Violet could see Michael through the window. He waved. She beamed.
"Oh, I've missed you,"
she exclaimed, hurrying forward as he hopped down.
"You must promise never to wait so long again."
"As if I could refuse you anything," he said, leaning down to kiss her cheek.
He turned then, holding his arm out to assist Francesca. Violet embraced her daughter, then stepped back to look at her. Franny was glowing. She was positively radiant.
"I missed you, Mother," she said.
Violet would have made a reply, but she found herself unexpectedly choked up. She felt her lips press together, then twitch at the corners as she fought to contain her tears. She didn't know why she was so emotional. Yes, it had been over a year, but hadn't she gone 342 days before? This was not so very different.
"I have something for you," Francesca said,
and Violet could have sworn her eyes were glistening too. Francesca turned back to the carriage and held out her arms. A maid appeared in the doorway, holding some sort of bundle, which she then handed down to her mistress. Violet gasped. Dear God, it couldn't be.
Mother,
Francesca said softly, cradling the precious little bundle.
This is John.
The tears, which had been waiting patiently in Violet's eyes, began to roll.
Franny,
she whispered, taking the baby into her arms.
Why didn't you tell me?
And Francesca, her maddening, inscrutable third daughter, said,
I don't know. He's beautiful,
Violet said, not caring that she'd been kept in the dark. She didn't care about anything in that moment, nothing but the tiny boy in her arms, gazing up at her with an impossibly wise expression.
He has your eyes, Violet said, looking up at Francesca.
Franny nodded, and her smile was almost silly, as if she couldn't quite believe it.
I know.
And your mouth.
I think you're right. And your... Oh, my. I think he has your nose as well.
I'm told, Michael said in an amused voice, that I was involved in his creation too, but I have yet to see any evidence.
Francesca looked at him with so much love that it nearly took Violet's breath away.
He has your charm, she said.
Violet laughed, and then she laughed again. There was too much happiness inside of her. She couldn't possibly hold it in.
I think it's time we introduced this little fellow to his family, she said. Don't you?
Francesca held out her arms to take the baby, but Violet turned away.
Not just yet, she said.
She wanted to hold him a while longer.
Maybe until Tuesday. Mother, I think he might be hungry.
Violet assumed an arch expression.
He'll let us know. But I know a thing or two about babies, Francesca Bridgerton Sterling.
Violet grinned down at John.
They adore their grandmamas, for example.
He gurgled and cooed, and then, she was positive, he smiled.
Come with me, little one, she whispered. I have so much to tell you.
And behind her, Francesca turned to Michael and said,
Do you think we'll get him back for the duration of the visit?
He shook his head, then added,
It'll give us more time to see about getting the little fellow a sister.
Michael! Listen to the man!
Violet called, not bothering to turn around.
Good heavens,
Francesca muttered. But she did listen, and she did enjoy. And 9 months later, she said good morning to Janet Helen Sterling, who looked exactly like her father. The End. This is Rosalind Landor. We hope you have enjoyed this production of When He Was Wicked, by Julia Quinn. Recorded books are available wherever audiobooks are sold. Thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.